Hi, this is Ivor Davies from Ice House, and you're listening to My 88.
Listening to My 88. Wayne Tunks with you this morning. I am so excited to chat to an icon of the music industry. It is Mr. Ivor Davies. Thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Now, Ivor, you are about to play at Panthers on the 5th of October. What can people expect from the show?
We've mainly been doing big outside festivals and stuff like that. So we carry way too much stuff, basically. and so it's a fairly big production, and we're very proud of all of our crew and the whole team that sort of put this thing together, because it's way more complicated than you'd care to imagine, but very impressive, hopefully. So yeah, we're looking forward to it very much.
Yes, it's going to be a great show. Now, Ice House have been around for such a long time. When you first started, did you expect that you'd still be touring all these years later?
You know, I had a very healthy kind of skepticism right from the beginning. Really, it started off as a kind of, you know, weekend hobby, I guess, is probably the way you best describe it. And you know, it was great. It's sort of a great fun thing to do when you're 22. But I don't think I really ever thought there would be a proper job in it. And in fact, right through to when we released our first recording, a song called Can't Help Myself, and I had a bet with a little tiny record company we were signed to, and I had a bet with one of the two partners who ran that it would never get into the top 40. Well, luckily, that's a bet that I lost. I really kind of didn't believe that you could actually make a living out of doing this stuff.
Now, of course, you changed your name from Flowers to Ice House. If you were still Flowers, do you think you would have had the success you did?
You know, I think that's probably a really difficult hypothetical to kind of get your head around. I guess there's been a lot of bands with very unlikely names. In a way, it worked out for us. We had no choice. We had to change our name because somebody else overseas was using the name Flowers. And I guess, you know, the reality is I'm kind of glad in a way, but whether it would have made any difference, I really don't know. That's a damn fine question.
Thank you. Now, Great Southern Land is just one of Australia's best ever songs. How did it feel making that tune?
Well, you know, the reality of it was at the time I was in a state of kind of sheer panic, really. The background was that we put out our very first album, and the songs on that album had been accumulated over a period of, you know, something like nearly 3 years. That's not a lot of productivity, but it was as fast as I could go. And then suddenly I found myself with only a couple of months to write an entire second album. And so I was just sort of terrified, really, and also kind of homeless at the time. I was sort of couch surfing. I stayed for a while on house-minded Rick Brewster from the Angels' house, and had a little tiny cassette player with me, and very rudimentary equipment to try and write anything with, and that was the very first song of that collection of songs that I wrote. So, you know, when I brought it into the managers and played the demo to them, and I said, look, I've made a start, you know, I mean, there's only 8 songs to go or 9 songs to go or something. And that was kind of my panic state at the time. So I guess the last thing I was thinking about was that you and I'd be talking here 40-something years later about that particular song. It's amazing, really.
Yeah, it certainly is, and what a brilliant tune it is. Now, Man of Colours is one of the biggest Australian albums of all time. Did that one feel special when you were recording it?
I think the threads that sort of went into kind of join up had been collecting for a while. There were a lot of things. For the first time on the album previous to that, I'd found a producer who I really loved working with. We'd had a sort of established band lineup for quite a while. I guess by the time you get your 5th album, you've got a bit of experience in a studio and you know how things work and what you're meant to do. There are a whole lot of sort of roads leading to Rome, as it were. And so I think we felt as if we had a good collection of songs and that we had a good collection of people. And it was really kind of, it was a working kind of environment. You know, this is what we've got to do next, and off we went. And so I guess you could kind of describe the result as a little bit magical, but at the time it felt that everything was in its right and proper place and we knew what we were doing. I guess it's probably the best way, that's the best way to describe how that felt. It certainly didn't feel like an amazingly magical experience at the time, just something that we knew that we could be very proud of, I think.
Yeah, fantastic. Now, you were having a lot of success overseas, but with that album, it's when it really cemented it, and you had a top 20 in the US with Crazy and then top 10 with Electric Blue. How incredible was that?
Yeah, well, that was a bit of a moment because we had earlier on quite a lot of success in Europe. We had a manager who was very focused on Europe, and his logic was that when you add up, you know, all the various populations of the countries in Europe, it's as big as North America, and so he felt that we were more suited to the European market stylistically, I guess. And then we had a change of managers, and that manager was absolutely focused on North America. And we toured and toured and toured North America. And I have to tell you, if you tour in a rock and roll band in a car North America, you very quickly learn how many cities there are in North America. It's massive, and we, you know, felt after even months and months and months and months, we hadn't even kind of scraped the sides, as it were, of making an impression in North America. And we had some limited success with the 4th album, and we had a number of songs in the top 50 in America. But I was having a little tiny holiday, and I had a routine with our manager, who was based in North America, to call him once a week at a certain time. And I remember going out, there wasn't a phone where I was staying, so I walked down the road to a phone booth and I rang him up at the appointed hour. And he said, Crazy has just gone on into the American top 20. And there I was in a phone booth on the northern New South Wales coast in a holiday resort. And I couldn't believe it. I just was, that was definitely a magical moment, a memorable moment. It was just many years of work had gone into getting to that point, and it was quite surreal standing in a phone booth and hearing it.
Oh, I bet. I bet that was wonderful. Touring in Australia in the 80s just sounds like it was an exciting and wonderful thing. What are your memories from those tours?
The various periods were kind of characterised by various kind of memories for me. I mean, certainly the very early days was extraordinary in the pub scene in Sydney, Melbourne, you know, Brisbane and Adelaide, and those incredibly hot, sweaty, jam-packed venues that we played, that Midnight Oil played, that Cold Chisel and the Angels and In Excess, and masses of bands, really good bands, and really hard work. And then, of course, our adventures took us overseas, and that was pretty interesting and extraordinary opportunities like touring with David Bowie for his very biggest tour of all time, and we were playing to in Europe to 45,000 people to 70,000 people. I've got a photo on my kitchen wall of one of those crowds at 70,000 people, and the crowd stretches further than the horizon, really. They're on the side of a hill, and the crowd keeps going over the hill. And there's David Bowie in his canary yellow suit. So extraordinary opportunities and incredibly diverse number of memories for all of those different periods.
Wow, that sounds incredible. Now, one last question. Australian music was just so amazing in the 80s. Why do you think that was?
Look, I've got various theories. We're kind of interesting period in music when there was a kind of changing of the guard after all the very big heavy rock bands like Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd and so on and so forth, and then an upstart from London called Johnny Rotten turned up with a band called the Sex Pistols and kind of changed everything overnight. But I think the thing that was, and we sort of entered at that point. So there was a real change of expectations, I think, from the crowd. All the old rules were broken, and the landscape was wide open. But the thing for me, I think, that really characterised that period was an incredible explosion in music technology. So kind of, every 5 minutes, some amazing piece of machinery was being invented. And, they were synthesizers, they were drum machines, they were effects units, there were all sorts of things going on. Even the technology of home recording, I guess, was developing in a period where it suited me because that's the way that I ended up writing songs, was with, tape recorders in my bedroom. But those things were actually literally being invented during the early 80s, and I'm sure it was the same for me as it was for any number of musicians around the world who just suddenly found themselves like a child in a toy shop, really, just going, wow, look at that. Think of the possibilities. And so an incredible amount of creative energy generated by technology, I think, was probably one of the reasons that contributed to that really golden period of creativity.
Yes, wonderful. Ivor, thank you so much for chatting today. And everyone needs to go see Ice House at Panthers on October 5. You're an absolute legend, Ivor. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is My 88.